Well, ladies and gentlemen and little ones, welcome. This is the study for December 9th, 2023. The time is 13:30 hours Eastern Standard Time. Ward Green with you today. Again, it's wonderful to see you. And I hope you're doing well. I love you. We've dated Adam to 5,550 years before the Common Era in the Greenology, and we're studying the article The Crucible of Credible Creed today. And this is chapter 1, paragraph 9. And we have dated the deluge to 3282 BCE. And while it is tempting to make more than minimal study of these earlier dates, we instead are concentrating more on the recenter dates, which find a more definite correlation in the sciences, and by virtue of recency, are less liable to be subjected to dire confusion. The earlier times are the subject of the previous article, which concentrated on the history after Noah's Ark. That sounds like that was the Ark of Urartu and the Orient Express. In this article, then, the focus is upon the history after Abraham to Jacob, Joseph, Moses, and the kings of Israel. And, of course, it includes the judges of Israel who came before the kings and after Moses. But we also, we should say, we haven't yet studied the Ark of Urartu. We've studied Born and Raised, and before that we did the Wild Road Ahead to History. And now, currently, we're studying the study for which is now concluded for today, but we're studying The Crucible of Credible Creed, which is really one of the most important articles in the series. It was an attempt to bring together everything refine history, just in the same way that the crucible refines metals by heating up and testing by heating up the facts and allowing the false facts or the scummy dross to come to the surface, so we can end up with a more pure reality of history. You know, that's the idea behind the Crucible article. And we already knew the chronology for the most part at the time we wrote the Crucible article. We didn't know the chronology of Egypt at the time this was written, until this was written. And even after this, that chronology continued to be refined, and everything can continue to be refined, probably to some extent, a little bit anyway. But this article was written after the most important articles like Green and Joseph and Joseph and Own, then Phoenix and then Moses had sort of gathered together these important ideas. And Trojan War was a great article too. They were all magnificent articles. Wild Road Ahead to History. But we can't do them all in one day. That's all for the Crucible for today too. Today's proverb, little children, is Ecclesiastes 6:11, because there exist many things that are causing much vanity. What advantage does a man have? So it's good to be reminded that life doesn't always seem exciting, and that that's normal according to the book of Ecclesiastes. Ecclesiastes, written by Solomon, he understood this fact and he was the most wise and interesting man perhaps who ever lived, other than Christ. He was a very, very interesting person, very wise man, and he knew this principle that it was very difficult to find out what advantage there was in life, because there was so much vanity in life. And that is refreshing to see it, because it reminds us that, okay, maybe we it's okay if we get bored maybe every once in a while. Maybe that's not the end in the world. The end of the world, or the be-all and end-all, or maybe that's not such a bad thing if we get bored occasionally. 2 Samuel 8, and it came about afterward that David proceeded to strike the Philistines down and subdue them. Let me check my list of what we're studying here. That's right. And David got to take Methegamma out of the hand of the Philistines, and he went on to strike down the Moabites and measure them with a line, making them lie down on the earth that he might measure two lines to put them to death, and a full line to preserve them alive. And the Moabites came to be David's servants to carry tribute. And David went on to strike down Hadadezer the son of Rehob, the king of Zobah, as he was going his way to put his control back again at the river Euphrates. And David got to capture from him 1,700 horsemen and 20,000 men on foot. And David proceeded to hamstring all the chariot horses, but he let 100 chariot horses of them remain. When Syria of Damascus came to help Hadadezer, the king of Zobah, David then struck down among the Syrians 22,000 men. Further, David put garrisons in Syria of Damascus, and the Syrians came to be David's servants to carry tribute. And Jehovah continued to save David wherever he went. Moreover, David took the circular shields of gold that happened to be on the servants of Hadadezer and brought them to Jerusalem. And for Beta and Barothai, cities of Hadadezer, King David took copper in very great quantity. Okay. Now Toi, the king of Hamath, got to hear that David had struck down all the military force of Hadadezer. So Toi sent Joram, his son, to King David to ask him about his welfare and congratulate him over the fact that he had fought against Hadadezer so that he struck him down, for Hadadezer had become trained in warfare against Toi, and in his hand there proved to be articles of silver and articles of gold and articles of copper. These also King David sanctified to Jehovah, together with the silver and the gold that he had sanctified from all the nations that he had subdued, from Syria and from Moab and from the sons of Ammon and from the Philistines and from Amalek and from the spoil of Hadadezer the son of Rehob, the king of Zobah. And David proceeded to make a name when he came back from striking down the Edomites in the Valley of Salt, 18,000, and he kept garrisons placed in Edom. In all Edom he placed garrisons, and all the Edomites came to be servants of David, and Jehovah kept saving David wherever he went. And David kept reigning over all Israel. And David was continually rendering judicial decision and righteousness for all his people. And Joab, the son of Zeruiah, was over the army. And Jehoshaphat, the son of Ahilud, was recorder. And Zadok, the son of Ahitub, and Ahimelech, the son of Abiathar, were priests. And Saraiah was secretary. And Benaiah, the son of Jehoiada, was over the Kerethites and the Pelethites. As for the sons of David, they became priests. But there's a footnote that says that maybe the sons of David didn't become priests. Maybe they became chiefs, because, of course, the Levites were the ones who were the priests. It was not permitted to be a priest if you weren't of the tribe of Levi, and David certainly was not. So that's one footnote. The other footnote that is of interest here also is that Ahimelech, the son of Abiathar, there's a footnote that says that the Syriac version says that Abiathar, the son of Ahimelech, was the priest. But, of course, Abiathar himself could have had another son called by the name of his own father, Ahimelech. So, and both the Septuagint and the Masoretic text agree that that the text as we just read it was correct. Ahimelech, the son of Abiathar, were priests. So that's a few things of note there, but that's the end of 2 Samuel chapter 8. Nothing of chronological significance there, nothing that would help us with our chronology, but it gives us a real sense, a better sense of what events were happening during David's time and what kind of a king he was and how much bloodshed there was also during the time of his rule. Now it came about that as soon as Jeremiah, this is from Jeremiah 43, finished speaking to all the people, all the words of Jehovah their God with which Jehovah their God had sent him to them, even all these words, Azariah the son of Hoshea and Johanan the son of Kareah and all the presumptuous men proceeded to say to Jeremiah, "It is a falsehood that you are speaking. Jehovah our God has not sent you, saying, 'Do not enter into Egypt to reside there as aliens.' But Baruch the son of Neriah is instigating you against us for the purpose of giving us into the hand of the Chaldeans to put us to death or to take us into exile in Babylon. And Johanan the son of Kareah and all the chiefs of the military forces and all the people did not obey the voice of Jehovah to keep on dwelling in the land of Judah. So Johanan the son of Kareah and all the chiefs of the military forces took all the remnant of Judah that had returned from all the nations to which they had been dispersed." The group of people is called a remnant. "In order to reside for a while in the land of Judah, even the able-bodied men and the wives and the little children and the daughters of the king, and every soul," of course the king had been Zedekiah, "and every soul that Nebuzaradan, the chief of the bodyguard, had let stay with Gedaliah, the son of Ahikam, the son of Shaphan, and Jeremiah the prophet, and Baruch, the son of Neriah, and they finally came into the land of Egypt. For they did not obey the voice of Jehovah, and they came gradually as far as Tophonies. Then the word of Jehovah occurred to Jeremiah in Tophonies, saying, 'Take in your hand great stones, and you must hide them in the mortar in the terrace of bricks that is at the entrance of the house of Pharaoh in Tophonies before the eyes of the Jewish men. And you must say to them, this is what Jehovah of armies, the God of Israel, has said. Here I am sending, and I will take Nebuchadrezzar, the king of Babylon, my servant, and I will place his throne right above these stones that I have hidden, and he will certainly extend his state tent over them. And he must come in and strike the land of Egypt. Whoever is due for deadly plague will be for deadly plague, and whoever is due for captivity will be for captivity, and whoever is due for the sword will be for the sword. And I will set a fire ablaze in the houses of the gods of Egypt, and he will certainly burn them and lead them captive and wrap himself up in the land of Egypt, just as a shepherd wraps himself up in his garment, and he will actually go out from there in peace, and he will certainly break to pieces the pillars of Beth Shemesh, which is in the land of Egypt, and the houses of the gods of Egypt he will burn with fire." Talking about Nebuchadnezzar, also called Nebuchadrezzar, the king of Babylon. In either case, he's the king of Babylon, and he's the one who had destroyed Jerusalem, and that's why they'd come to Egypt ultimately, partly because of the disobedience of this man who was leading this group, Johanan, the son of Kareah. And so that's the end of Jeremiah 43. Now Matthew chapter 17. 6 days later, Jesus took Peter and James and John, his brother. 6 days after what happened yesterday in our reading, which was several things. The leaven of the Pharisees and Sadducees, and about giving up one's soul for the sake of Jesus, being the way by which we gain our souls, we get everlasting life. And chapter 17. 6 days later, Jesus took Peter, James, and John, his brother, along, and brought them up into a lofty mountain by themselves. And he was transfigured before them, and his face shone as the sun, and his outer garments became brilliant as the light. And look, there appeared to them Moses and Elijah conversing with him. Responsibly, Peter said to Jesus, "Lord, it is fine for us to be here. If you wish, I will erect 3 tents here, one for you, and one for Moses, and one for Elijah." While he was yet speaking, look, a bright cloud overshadowed them, and look, a voice out of the cloud saying, "This is my Son, the Beloved, whom I have approved. Listen to him." At hearing this, the disciples fell upon their faces and became very much afraid. Then Jesus came near and, touching them, said, "Get up and have no fear." When they raised their eyes, they saw no one but Jesus himself only. And as they were descending from the mountain, Jesus commanded them, saying, "Tell the vision to no one until the Son of Man is raised up from the dead." However, the disciples put the question to him, "Why then do the scribes say that Elijah must come first?" In reply, he said, "Elijah indeed is coming and will restore all things. However, I say to you that Elijah has already come, and they did not recognize him, but did with him the things they wanted. In this way, also, the Son of Man is destined to suffer at their hands." Then the disciples perceived that he spoke to them about John the Baptist. And when they came toward the crowd, a man approached him, kneeling down to him and saying, "Lord, have mercy on my son, because he is an epileptic and is ill, for he falls often into the fire and often into the water, and I brought him to your disciples, but they could not cure him." In reply, Jesus said, "O faithless and twisted generation, how long must I continue with you? How long must I put up with you? Bring him here to me." Then Jesus rebuked it, and the demon came out of him, and the boy was cured from that hour. Thereupon the disciples came up to Jesus privately and said, "Why is it we could not expel it?" He said to them, "Because of your little faith. For truly I say to you, if you have faith the size of a mustard grain, you will say to this mountain, 'Transfer from here to there,' and it will transfer, and nothing will be impossible for you." It was while they were gathered together in Galilee that Jesus said to them, "The Son of Man is destined to be betrayed into men's hands, and they will kill him, and the third day he will be raised up." Consequently, they were very much grieved. After they arrived in Capernaum, the men collecting the 2 drachmas tax approached Peter and said, "Does your teacher not pay the 2 drachmas? He said, "Yes." However, when he entered the house, Jesus got ahead of him by saying, "What do you think, Simon? From whom do the kings of the earth receive duties or head tax? From their sons or from the strangers?" When he said, "From the strangers," Jesus said to him, "Really then, the sons are tax-free, but that we do not cause them to stumble. You go to the sea, cast a fish hook, and take the first fish coming up, and when you open its mouth, you will find a stater coin. Take that and give it to them for me and you." That's the end of Matthew chapter 17. So look at what Jesus did there. He did so many miracles, and then he even prophesied that Peter would find a coin in the mouth of a fish. And that's how they paid their tax. It's just astounding, is it not? All the miracles that Jesus performed that we know about, which are a great many. I want to show you something. There's a video that this is Ron Wyatt. I don't think I've shown this before. Now let's get it so we can maybe magnify it a little bit, so it's not, or maybe it's okay. But I want to play this. So I'll have to re-zero the audio, or to get back to the beginning of the part. Is it playing? Why is it not giving audio here? I've muted my audio. No? Oh, the audio's not working. That's strange. That wasn't broken before. Oh, I've turned it off. That's why, yeah. Well, I have to turn it on again. Okay, let me turn it on. Let's turn on the audio. I hope that's all that's going on here. Let's see, sound, and what do we got?
I said, take some of the white blood cells and put them in a growth medium.
That's it.
And
let's go back.
I said, take some of the white.
Let's go back.
Tell me about it.
That's
not
here it is.
Okay. Dried blood.
Here it is. Listen to this.
You said that you had the blood of our Lord examined by the Israelis.
That's correct.
What was their determination of that?
Okay. Dried blood is dead blood. Everybody knows that. However, there's no way I know that you can get a chromosome count out of dead blood. You can get a DNA and some other things, but not a chromosome count. All right? That's done by living white blood cells. I took the blood into a laboratory in Israel. I just said, please examine this blood and tell me what you can tell me about it. They said, it's human blood. We can tell that. They did whatever tests they need to do. And then I said, take some of the white blood cells and put them in a growth medium. And keep them at body temperature for 48 hours. And they said, well, that'll do no good because it's dead blood. I said, would you please do that for me? And they said, okay, we'll do it. Examined it under a microscope. And the one technician called the other one over there. And then they called the boss over there. And they looked at me and they said, Mr. Wyatt, this human blood only has 24 chromosomes in it. Everybody else has 46. You see, 23 from your mother, 23 from your father. This blood had 23 chromosomes from the mother's side, one Y chromosome only. They said, this blood is alive. And then they said, whose blood is this? I said, it's the blood of your Messiah.
Come on, somebody ought to give God praise for the blood. I said,
so Ron Wyatt. But there's more, because the 23 chromosomes are the autosomal chromosomes of the mother. And Ron, that was an edited video. Ron said more than this, more than what was shown there. But that was the essence of it. But there's the idea that the chromosomes of the mother are enough to ensure that the body would be developing correctly and that that everything would be right, but there was one chromosome needed from the father, and that was the sex chromosome, which for a male is a Y chromosome that determines the sex to be male rather than female. But the thing is, this is the remarkable thing was the blood was alive, so it hadn't deteriorated, and all the chromosomes were there, but there were only 24 of them. It was living blood, though. That's the thing that was so remarkable. Thousands of years old, too, was the what was the belief there, because this was blood that Ron had found underground on the Ark of the Covenant, that he had found underground, which was under the site. It had been stored underground during the time when there were attacking armies and so on at Jerusalem, and when it was stored underground, it turned out that it was directly under the place where Christ was crucified, and when there was the crucifixion, there was an earthquake that cracked the ground, and the crack allowed the blood and water, which was obtained when the soldier stabbed the already deceased Christ in the side, that blood and water flowed down through the crack and ended up on the Ark of the Covenant, on the cover of the Ark of the Covenant. And Ron had obtained a sample of it without knowing what it was and taken it to a laboratory and found out it was human blood and so on. That was the story that we just saw. Quite a remarkable story. Just incredible, phenomenal, miraculous story, but also not that we need it to prove that we believe in Christ at all, but it's so reassuring for a believer who does believe this account of Ron Wyatt, and you can tell from his account, if you hear the whole account, there's more to it than what was said there. He knows a lot more about blood because of having discovered, you know, and talked to these experts, then you might, you know, think, because he himself is not a PhD or anything like that, I don't believe. Maybe I've heard someone call him a doctor. I don't believe he's a PhD at all. I think he's not in any sense qualified academically as a PhD. So what am I looking for here? Oh yeah, I know what I'm looking for. Let's go back. What do we got? Is this it? Let's see. This is it. Yeah. I'm looking for chapter 12 of the Born and Raised article and paragraph 7. Maybe we'll have time now to read this. I think we do have time to read the footnote that I wanted to read this. Okay. Nisan 15 was a Saturday when Nisan 1 is taken as March 25th in the year 30 CE. But Nisan 15 was a Saturday because of that. Okay. From Gauchi's work, the March 25th is the day after the first visibility on March 24th evening from her work. And there was no work permitted on the Saturday by either the Pharisees or the Sadducees. This opened up the possibility that Jesus may have had his Passover evening meal, which he ate with his 12 apostles on Thursday, right, along with both the Sadducees and the traditional Jews, and that the crucifixion came on Friday. You might think that it would open up that possibility anyway. Friday, Nisan 14, could have been the crucifixion, which would be the traditional date for the crucifixion, but you know, but we're going to say why that's not true. In this case, the Friday was April 7th, 30 CE. This fails, however, according to Luke 23 and 56, because it was not allowed to do any work on the day of the Passover, and they had gone to prepare spices and then rested on the Sabbath, it said. But they couldn't prepare spices because they weren't allowed to work on the Passover from Exodus 12 and 16, which excludes, so they couldn't have worked on the day of the crucifixion. That was a Passover day. So he couldn't have been crucified on that day. But also, they couldn't have crucified Jesus because that was work. They couldn't do that on the Passover either. So that excludes the possibilities of work such as executing Jesus or preparation of spices. This doesn't preclude that Nisan 14 was Friday. That's still true. In the assumption of Nisan 1 being March 25th, Nisan 14's Friday, April 7th, in 30 CE, for both Sadducees and Pharisees. That's still true, making their days of Passover Friday and Saturday, respectively. But that's only, of course, if we have Nisan 1 given as above. But it puts the crucifixion date on Thursday, which was Nisan 14 of the Essenes, only in the year 30 CE. And of course, since Jesus' disciples were not his other disciples anyway, his main body of disciples, and possibly him, were not Essenes. None of them were Essenes. So they could have worked on the Passover day of the Essenes, but they could have had their evening meal on the same night the Essenes did. Only in the year 30 CE, though, because the Essene evening meal of Passover was on the Wednesday evening in that year, but of course the Essenes would not have called it Wednesday because they had a different day of the week than everyone else in this particular year. Their day of the week always was a Wednesday, always on the New Year's Day for them. So they would have called this particular evening Monday evening, because Nisan 1 was always a Wednesday for them, which made for them Nisan 14 always a Tuesday. But that's not Tuesday as we know it, it's just the Essene Tuesday. So they would have eaten their meal on Monday, on their Monday evening. And in the year 30 CE, only is the Essene Tuesday shifted from our Tuesday by either 1 or 2 days. This, it's shifted depending on when we assume the Essene Nisan 1 is, or when we also assume how we position Nisan 1 for both or either, you know, the Essenes or for the Pharisees and Sadducees and everybody else. There are two groups, the Essenes and everybody else. And where we put the nisan 1 for each of them determines whether there's a gap of 1 or 2 days there. We think it has to be 1 or 2 days because, you know, Jesus' trial couldn't have been longer than 2 days. This actually makes it possible for there to have been either a difference of 1 or 2 days in 30 CE between the weekdays, which is irrelevant, but with the difference in nisan 14 remaining just 1 day. Right, even though the weekday names are different by 2 days possibly, nisan 14 still only differed by 1 day. That's what we're looking for, because that makes it possible that he could have eaten just 1 day earlier the evening meal. From the historical notes at the end of the article, HN5B, we see another way of explaining how it was that Jesus could have eaten his Passover 1 day before those who held the meal on the eve of Nisan 14. We would have thought that he would have held the meal on the eve of Nisan 14. But, of course, he could have held it on Nisan 14 of the Essenes. It's like, you know, my great-grandfather used to, he didn't care what church he went to, or, you know, if he could go to a service, he wasn't particular about, or, you know, that, it's that sort of thing. It's a non-sectarian attitude is what I'm talking about. Jesus may have had that attitude and said, well, we can eat our evening meal on the night the Essenes do. Specifically, the practice about celebrating the evening meal is what we're talking about, but also there was a practice which was peculiar to the Galileans, that they ate a meal called the Last Supper, and it was eaten 1 day before their Passover, or the standard Passover, was eaten. And also, it permits a crucifixion 1 day before the Passover festival, if he was crucified the next day, right? Which we know is not permitted, you know, from Exodus 12 and 16, the Passover does not permit work on that day. On the first day of Passover. From Matthew 26 and 17, however, combined with the necessity of Jesus' sacrifice occurring on Nisan 14, in fulfillment of the law of Moses at Exodus 12 and 6, the meal eaten by Jesus is only explained by the Essene Passover falling 1 day or perhaps 2 before the Sadducee Passover. Exodus 12 and 6 is that they had to slaughter the lamb on the 14th day, right? So that's the idea, that Jesus had to die on the 14th day of Nisan. It was just important. So the fact that the Essene Passover fell 1 day before, or 2 days before the Sadducee Passover, and only in that year 30 CE could this have been true, that allowed his sacrifice to come on Nisan 14, which would fulfill the law of Moses at Exodus 12 and 6. Okay? So that's all we have for today, because that's all the time we have for today. It's December 9th, 2023, and it's 14:03 hours Eastern Standard Time. I'm Ward Green. I love you very much. All of you, have a wonderful day. This is, on my behalf, I've got another watch today. I've got my seagull watch, Gully, and I have my digital watch, Cassie. And on my behalf, they're saying bye for now.